When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good morning, everybody. 11:07 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on WSB. So much to talk about. We are going to dig in to the whole Thomas Gilbert Jr. murder because there are so many interesting details that have come out as the will of his father, who he is charged with murdering. Fascinating story, and I think it has so many lessons for all of us out here. First, I want to let you know that WitNation.com, which is Grant Cardone, you've heard him as a guest here on the show many, many times before, WitNation.com has started running my Big Money Real Estate show. There's a 30-minute show, and then there's a daily update, and it is fantastic. We've been tweeting it out. So you can either go to WitNation.com, W-I-T, whatever it takes, nation.com. There are so many great shows on this thing. They already have, it's only been up and running a couple of months. They have 8 million video views a month going on. It's just been amazing. There are just such amazing shows there with amazing people. Anyway, mine is up there, Big Money Real Estate, on the Whatever It Takes Network, WitNation.com. If you follow me on Twitter, you're going to see all kinds of links to it. Grant and his people have been pushing it out like crazy, and all kinds of people are following us, and I really want you to get all this amazing information. People have been so kind about what they've said about it. I am absolutely honored to be able to do this with Grant. And now what we're doing is prepping for a three-hour, this is going to be amazing, webinar that we're going to do sometime in February. I will let you know as soon as the date is set. But we are out there making this work. We're going to do consulting as part of it. There's all kinds of really cool stuff that's going to happen. So go to WitNation.com or follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and check out Big Money Real Estate. It is just way cool, and we are taping it every day. We've got a new one every day, 3 to 5 minutes. I'm doing interviews with some of the most interesting people out there in investing in real estate with what's going on today. I finally have a way when we've got news and information and, brand new studies and surveys, I've now got a way to get that information to you right away. So check it out, WitNation.com. My show is called Big Money Real Estate. All right, let me throw the number out there, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. The lines are completely open, wide open, folks. So while I start talking about the Gilberts and what a crazy, messed up world this is, feel free to call in with your real estate, money, and investing questions so we can get everybody going and start to answer some of your concerns. I want to make sure we're getting to you and giving you the information you need. So the New York Times today is calling the Gilbert murder the Prince of Privilege. Thomas Gilbert Jr., who honestly looks like some hot model with his sort of sandy blonde tousled hair, and he had he's got like kind of a scruffy little beard and this piercing look, right? Good looking guy, and you think this is a guy who has had everything handed to him his whole life. He went to Deerfield Academy, which is a private prep school. He then went to Princeton. His father and his uncle went to Princeton. And when he allegedly murdered his father, this world in Manhattan, this upper socialite world, was aghast, right? I mean, his dad was a graduate of Andover, another elite boarding school, went to Princeton, was running a hedge fund. And they were members of the list. They really were very, in that upper echelon of things. And people have said the nicest things about his dad. But it's so interesting this week, as I've been following this, to see that the onion of privilege and what this looked like was really not at all what it was, which was initially portrayed as the son being mad at his father for cutting his allowance by $100 a week. But what was that allowance? It was $600 plus the $2,400 a month that he was paying for his rent, right? So on top of that, he had another $2,400. So he was giving his son $50,000, $60,000 a year to cover his rent and his weekly allowance. What was that about? But regardless of what that was about, what it wasn't about was this huge privileged lifestyle that everybody assumed that the dad, who supposedly, when the numbers first came out, was running a $200 million hedge fund, turns out to be a $7 million hedge fund with plans to grow it to $15 million this year. And while there's nothing wrong with a $7 million hedge fund, the way hedge funds work is something called the 20 and 20. This is a typical thing where, or two, sorry, 2 and 20, where the hedge fund owners get 2% off the top, which on $7 million just isn't that much money. And then for all the profits that come in, they typically get another 20% and sometimes as much as 40% of the profits that are generated. But when you have a $2 billion hedge fund, that's a lot of money. When you have a $7 million hedge fund, it's not a lot of money. And so this idea that the dad was running a $200 million hedge fund but was cheating his son or only giving his son $600 a week allowance and cutting that back, that's one kind of a story of privilege. But digging deeper this week, we find out that the hedge fund really wasn't what it seemed. The dad was already downsizing, and when his estate was estimated, it seemed to be just a small amount of money, which was about $1.5 million. Now, I'm not saying that that is not a significant sum, but for this lifestyle, for this kind of privilege, or what was assumed to be, that's not a lot of money, particularly since a third of it was invested in the hedge fund. So really, the amount that he seems to have had in cash and stock and equity and other things just isn't that much. It could be, and I'm going to go out here on a limb and say, it could very well be that this is another case of living on your credit cards, on living beyond where you really are comfortable living. He and his wife, the dad, had sold their place, had moved into a rental at a respectable address. But even a rental, as expensive as that is in Manhattan, is a lot less expensive than owning property. And they had begun to downsize their life, and he was looking to do something else. Now, his son, as it turns out, has had, and the New York Times story is really interesting, has had problems for years. And the dad had spent probably a vast fortune trying to get his son the best help medically, psychologically, and all the rest. And for whatever reason, this kid, it just didn't work. And it's so interesting when I think about all of the people, and we watch this on television all the time, it's the Kardashian lifestyle, right? One new Fendi bag after another, one new outrageously expensive Chanel outfit after another. And we see this, our kids see this lifestyle that is just truly unattainable by any but the very, very, very most wealthy. There was another story this is in the Sunday Styles in the New York Times, which arguably is my favorite newspaper section printed anywhere every week. And this guy who bet against the housing boom correctly and ended up making, $200 million just by this bet, and has since parlayed that to $3 billion and bought a 24-acre property on the West Coast, which he is now selling for $195 million, just, I think, to call it the most expensive house for sale in America. And there is some cachet to that. There are very few people who can afford that kind of a lifestyle. There are very few people who can afford to spend $24, $25 million in a house and then invest another $30 million into it to then sell it for $195 million. I wouldn't want to undersell that. But the appearance that we get by looking in the media today is that everybody has that kind of wealth. Everybody has that kind of disposable income. And if you look at the numbers that have been coming out week by week, you realize that it's nowhere near the case. And that for the vast majority of Americans, they're still struggling, that the recession still feels like it's not over, that for whatever you have gained back in the stock market, there are a lot of people for whom that drop down to 6,000 back in 2009, despite the fact we're triple it now, their stocks haven't tripled. Their net worth hasn't tripled. Their livelihood has eaten away at so much of their financial future and stability. And I think it's so easy to get sucked into this. And I was so, it's this story of the Gilberts is such a sad, horrible story that I'm pretty sure it's going to be a movie of the week, like in 6 months. And I say that with just a hint of irony, right? We love in America to read about stories of riches to rags. And we love reading rags to riches, right? We love this transformative story of money and power and prestige. But the real world is not the world lived on Twitter, and it's not the world lived in a glittery Manhattan hedge fund lifestyle. It's really what we do every single day to make those smart saving choices a priority in our lives, so that what we do for our kids and for ourselves is to build a solid financial future. One that we can rely on no matter what happens to the stock market. 18 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Phone lines are open. 404-872-0750. 1-800-WSB-TALK. Happy to take your calls here on WSB.
This is Scott Slade. Join us Monday for Atlanta's Morning News for any breaking news of the war on terror and how many sunny days we'll have before the next chance of rain in the five-day forecast. First thing, King Holiday Monday morning on WSB.
It's 21 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. Our number, 404-872-0750. Or if you'd like me to pay for the cost of your call, well, not me, but Pete Spriggs, our boss, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You can also tweet me things at Glink, at GLINK. I have a Facebook fan page with 6,000-plus fans. You should join us there, too, because that's where we actually post all the really cool Ask Elise questions. And we point you to the answers, and then, of course, there's commentary, because everybody's got commentary. So here's something I got this week that you may have also gotten, which was a note from your favorite mortgage lender, or maybe somebody who would like to be your favorite mortgage lender, that interest rates are now near historic lows again. Truly down again, which was crazy. 30-year fixed rate mortgage declined by another 5 basis points this week, 5/100ths, to land at about 3.8%. That is the lowest average seen since May 17th of 2013, almost 2 years ago. The 15-year went down another 8 basis points, which is now, for a typical 15-year fixed rate mortgage, 3.16. Fully insured FHA-backed 30-year mortgages are below even their conforming counterparts, right? And they're at about 3.5% for a 30-year. The 5/1 hybrid ARM adjustable rate mortgage, that thing fell by 13 basis points. Get this. I can't even believe this. It landed at 2.96% for the week. And that's the first time it's been below 3% since June of 2013. So we are seeing mortgage interest rates continue to dive. And what's going on with that? Well, it has to do with what's going on with the world economy. This was such a crazy, shaky week. Switzerland uncoupled consciously, we're going to use the Gwyneth Paltrow, consciously uncoupled from the franc, the French franc. And the euro basically went bananas. Because everybody's been depending, I guess, on Switzerland printing, untold amounts of money in order to stabilize that price ratio. And that came out of nowhere. Just a few days after Switzerland had reaffirmed that it was going to continue to do it. But even they had reached a wall. Very interesting. And the world got very, very, very shaky very quickly. And there's so much that's been going on in France, right? So the focus on France and the Je suis Charlie movement and the entire march, which was incredible. And I saw estimates of between 2 and 4 million people marching in France. and what's going on around the world, it just got very shaky. And so what happens when things get shaky? Everybody does the flight quality. And what is quality? Well, it's U.S. right now. We're looking like this beacon of stability in a world where things are getting very, very shaky and scary. It's shaky and scary in China. It's shaky and scary in India. Things look a little strange all over Europe, where they're really mounting a war against deflation, right? It's not even just lack of growth. They're very worried about deflation. And some of the numbers coming out of there look very bad. Latin America is looking crazy. There's a lot of instability in the financial markets right now, and we saw it all pop up in the bond market. And so when you have this flight to quality, people are rushing to go there because in some places around the country, there's negative interest rates going on. People would put, if you put a dollar into certain countries in, let's say, a savings account, you're going to have to pay to keep your money there. It's not like they pay you even 1% or 0.01% interest. This is negative stuff we're talking about. Negative interest rates. And so everybody is completely freaking out. So what are they doing? They're coming to the U.S. and they're buying into the bond market, which just means that the interest rate is going down, right? What happens when lots and lots of people want something? Price tends to go up, which means the yield goes down. And that's how bonds work. So we are seeing mortgage interest rates drop. And that's good news for you. So we're seeing, let's see, gas and oil plummet. So at the pump, there's more money. We saw a lot of people really confused on CNBC and CNN this week on why people who are saving all this money in gas and oil prices at the pump, why they didn't turn around and spend all that money at Christmas. We saw the numbers for retail sales drop by an astonishing almost 1%. Way above expectations. I've got some thoughts about why you're not doing that, and we'll talk about that coming back. But interest rates are still sliding, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that. So we're going to talk about that and what you should do in terms of refinancing when we come back. Lines are still open, folks. I know it's a holiday weekend, but, you know, pick up the phone. Give me a call if you've got questions. If not, it's going to be a very, a lot of information I'm going to be throwing your way this today. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Kling Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
It's 11:36 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here in WSB, 404-872-0750. That is our number. Delighted to have you around today. All right, let's go to the phone, see what's going on. John joins me on the line from Athens. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I really enjoy your show. I appreciate what you do for everybody out there.
Thank you. Thanks for saying it, and thanks for joining us on this holiday weekend. What's on your mind?
Well, I got a question for you in regards to some rental property. I've got a couple rental houses, and I've had them for about 6 years now, and I don't have them in an LLC. What are your thoughts on that? As far as should I put those in some kind of separate company, LLC, incorporate them somehow? What's your recommendation on that?
Well, so the thing is that people sign up for LLCs or limited liability companies because they think it's going to put a legal layer of liability between themselves and what happens with the property. And eventually, if you do decide that you're going to make real estate sort of more of a business than just a couple of different houses, then you might want to do that or start to think about it. But it adds a whole layer of complication to what you're doing. And if you've got mortgages in those properties, it can be kind of tough because then the mortgages can be callable if you don't get the permission of the lenders, and the lenders don't give the permission because they're, you know, those loans are typically not commercial property loans. So they're sold and resold and all the rest. So if you decide to do this, you could do it going forward, but you would have to have a lawyer help you set up the LLC. Do not try to do this at home. This is one of those things where I'm like, don't try this on your own. Have the lawyer set it up, and then you've got to transfer the properties into the LLC and then make sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, because otherwise if somebody turns around and sues you and it's not done properly, it's as if you didn't do it at all. So that's the only kind of benefit, is that this layer of liability. But the detrimental side of it is that there's lots of complication. It can be harder to get mortgages because, you know, just as other creditors couldn't go after you or there's liability protection, lenders also have a tougher time going after property that's in an LLC. So
okay,
that's my thinking about it. Is it going well for you the way you're doing it now?
You know what it is? I haven't had any issues other than some bad tenants along the way. And
who doesn't? Okay,
yeah.
Who doesn't?
the laws out there definitely aren't in favor of the landlord, and you can spend a lot of money trying to evict somebody and then garnish their wages, but then you got to find them. And then once you do find them, they switch jobs. So it's just a battle. People think that you're a rich landlord, but really it's quite the opposite in a lot of cases. But
John, an LLC is not going to help with any of that. You know that.
No, I didn't think. I just, after listening to what you were saying, you're definitely right. It's not going to change things. I just was maybe concerned about if somebody was to get injured in the rental house or something was to happen, if the house was to catch on fire, something like that, how that would cross over into me, you know, my personal life as far as being able to sue for things like that, if the LLC would protect that.
Well, do you have umbrella liability coverage?
No, I do not.
So this may be a stepping stone for you. Everybody who has rental property should look into some sort of umbrella liability coverage. And what that does is it gives you another safety net over all the other insurance you're carrying on the property. So all insurance carries generally some liability coverage, but this gives you an added layer. And maybe you need $2 million or $5 million or $10 million, I don't know what you need, but it's not terribly expensive. And so when you put that in, it covers all of these other questions. And for small landlords, it isn't the be-all, end-all, but it's definitely worth investigating and talking to your insurance agent about, and making sure that if somebody trips and falls and sues you, right, that you've got this kind of extra liability coverage that, yes, an LLC would handle, but this is, you know, you're not really, I'm going to say, don't take, it's not pejorative, right? You're not really big enough to have, I think, an LLC for each different property that you own. Now, some people set it up that way, and that's how they do it, and that's fine. And when you're buying, you know, bigger buildings, maybe you're buying a 4-flat or a 6-flat or an 8-flat or, you know, a 20-unit apartment building, if you graduate into that, then each of those properties probably should have an LLC and be set up specifically for that. And there are benefits when you get into larger kinds of investments. But at the moment, I think it's overkill for you.
Gotcha. Well, perfect. Well, thank you so much, and I'll look into the umbrella policy and go from there. I do appreciate all your help.
Oh, you're welcome, John. And, you know, you would probably really benefit from my Big Money Real Estate Daily Update series, which is free on WhitNation.com, because we cover topics like this. And once a week, I take one of those daily updates, which are Monday to Friday, and I take somebody's question and I go in depth on it, just like we do right here on the show. And so those things sit at WhitNation.com, and we push out about them on Twitter and LinkedIn and all the other places, my G+ account, all the places that we communicate with folks. So you should check that out. I think you'd really like them. 42 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time. Let's go to Gloria in Lawrenceville. Hi, Gloria.
Hi. Actually, it's Zoya. I didn't have a chance to correct her name.
It is Elise, and you are Gloria, and this is the Elise Glink Show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for taking my call. The question is, back in May last year, I purchased a little townhouse. My APR is 4.25. I made improvements. I built a kitchen, like granite new cabinets, made a lot of improvements. And now I know the interest even lower. Does it make sense to me to refinance? And would it be appraised higher so I can get rid of PMI? It's not like it's a big PMI, but...
Well, so that's a good question. So there's, I have to ask you some questions now. So how much did you put down on the property?
I put down 10%.
Okay. And what's going on in your neighborhood? Are all the foreclosures gone?
As far as I know, there's no foreclosures.
Okay.
It's just, not that many. Where I am at, it's a small community, like one row of small townhouses, like about 12 of them in a row, and that's it.
Okay. So you should probably talk to a local real estate agent, maybe even the woman who sold or man who sold you your townhouse last year, and ask what's going on and what townhouses like yours or properties like yours in the neighborhood are selling for. Because they'll tell you, and then you can talk about how you've improved the property and what you've put into the property, and they may say to you, right, this would be, yes, it's gone up 10% or 15%, or with what you've done, it now would probably, maybe you'll get an extra $30,000. So the real...
That's exactly what I put, almost, I mean, a little bit more than $30,000 I put into it.
So I would start with talking to the real estate agent who sold you the property and have this conversation with him or her about what other homes you're selling for and what you've done to the property. Now, there's always a danger that you've over-improved your property for the short period of time you've lived there. Every year, there's a cost versus value survey from Remodeling Magazine, which we talk about, and I think it just recently came out, the new one for 2014. So every year, they talk about a kitchen upgrade, major kitchen upgrade, being the number one thing that pays back, but it still doesn't pay back 100% within a year. Over time, it makes your property much more valuable. But unless you bought your property at a discount, a substantial discount, and then put that in, you know, then it might...
Yes, I have.
Okay, so then maybe it has. But again, you know, I can't tell you because I don't know where it is or what it is, but your real estate agent would be able to tell you. I can focus on, for a minute, why you might want to refinance. Now, you got 4.25% on a loan that you only put 10% down on. Now, did you do an 80? You didn't do an 80-10-10 because you're paying PMI. Did you get an FHA loan?
No, just the regular conventional.
Regular conventional loan at 90%. So your APR would have been higher anyway. So getting your loan down to 80% is going to be key. Do you have any cash left that you could put towards the mortgage?
Not after my remodeling.
Okay, so you're tapped out, as they like to say.
Right.
So you need to, you know, before you invest money in a refinance, because they're going to charge you for the appraisal, I would want to know where things are going in the neighborhood. And then you can decide if you can actually change it. Now, the thing you'd want to do is you would actually want to go from a 30-year to a 15-year if you could. And I've got four rules for a home run refinance. And I think you should keep this in mind as you're looking to refinance. And everybody should, because this is truly the most important thing that you can do, right? Evaluate this correctly. Number one, can you lower the interest rate? Well, your APR is at 4.25%. I started the show by talking about 30 years are now down at 3.5%. So, yes, you could probably lower the interest rate. Number two, can you lower your monthly payment? Because that's always important. Number three, and this is the most important of the four, can you shorten the loan term? Because even if you cannot lower your monthly payment, but you can go from a 29 years left on your loan to 15 years left on the loan, you're going to save a significant amount of interest over the life of that mortgage. And this is the time to lock that in, because you should be able to go all the way down to around 3.375% if
wow.
with a 15-year, which might be the same payment as you're making, which would be a home run in and of itself, or slightly above what you're paying. And then the fourth thing is to absolutely be careful about the closing costs and the points that you're paying. You really have to shop that stuff around and make a decision about whether you pay out of pocket, it gets folded into the loan amount. Those four things, if you can do those four things, Gloria, together, that is a home run refinance in my book. So lowering the interest rate, lowering the mortgage payment, shortening your loan term, and being very cautious about how much you're paying out of pocket for closing costs. If you do all of those four things, if you check all of those four boxes, you have done a home run refinance, and you don't even have to call back. You should just go and sign the papers. And then if you can only do three of the four, you're probably still in a triple. That's good. I would do that also. If you're only getting to two, then you have to decide whether or not it's going to be worth the time, trouble, and effort to do it. It isn't always worth that. But for you, your path starts with the real estate agent that sold you this house so that you can see, because you really need it to go up. For you, refinancing and eliminating PMI is going to free up $100 a month or maybe even $200 a month. That in itself, for you, would be a home run refinance, and everything else is a grand slam. 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Klink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on WSB.
Elise Klink, Sundays on News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
It's 11:55 on the Elise Klink Show. Holiday weekend, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. On WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Bob joins me on the line from Mableton. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Beautiful day.
Nice.
I have a question about a traditional IRA that I've not contributed to in a long time.
How did you end up with it?
Well, I worked for a company for 10 years and left, and then 3 years later, I guess the company dissolved and they sent me a check. And it was only about $8,900, and I was told that I needed to reinvest it or, you know, I'd have to pay taxes on it, so I did. I just put it back into an IRA.
Mm-hmm. And what did you invest it in the IRA?
Well, originally I put it with an insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, traditional IRA, and then I moved it out of that company to, I guess, fund management company, and so the original amount was $8,900. Right now, I recently found an app called SigFig, okay, and I linked it together, and I was able to really look at, you know, how this thing has been doing over time, because I don't know what it. Anyway, I'm not well-versed in all of it. But anyway, I just know that right now it's worth about $15,200.
Okay.
I never contributed any money to it.
This is great.
And so it's sitting there. And now because it's on my phone, I'm more aware of, you know, I'm looking at it, what it's been doing all over time and how much I've paid for them to manage it and all that. You know, I just wonder if I should just leave it alone as I have or converted to a Roth.
So let me just start by saying it's hard to know. So you said 10 years ago you worked for a company for 10 years. How long ago did you invest it?
When I got the check, it was in 1992.
Okay, so 1992, and it's basically 2002, 2012. Like you're 22 years later.
Right,
and it's doubled
it
in
went
20.
Down as low as $7,200. You know,
okay.
I remember seeing that it was low. It's
so I can just tell you. I don't know what you're invested in, but I can just tell you that doubling over 20 years isn't a particularly great growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very little, and I don't know. I can just tell you that it's only doubled, and everything else in the market has tripled. That whatever you're invested in is not very aggressive, and you've paid a lot of money for it. So
that's what my guess is.
The truth is that you should, if you want to be in something a little bit cheaper, you should probably move it to an index fund either held by Vanguard or Fidelity, because they're the two cheapest, and you'll pay just a tenth of 1% to actually manage it. And then you can put it into any number of mutual index funds, which will give you better growth or at least meet the marketplace. So whatever happens in the general oversized market would happen for this money as well. And I would probably then just leave it alone because you won't be paying very much to hold it, and it'll grow very slowly again over time, and you'll, you know, rise and fall with the market, but you won't have to worry about how much you're paying, and you won't have to worry about what it's invested in. Okay. And those two things alone, I think, will be really smart moves to make. And over time, one day, it may be $20,000, $30,000. You're going to take it out, liquidate it, and do something good with it. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, answering your money and real estate questions. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
It's 12:07 on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Phone numbers, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB, talk. Don't forget to check out witnation.com, WITNATION, for my Big Money Real Estate Show. It's a daily update, 3 to 6 minutes, I think one of them is even, where I talk about all kinds of things relating to investing in real estate. Very, very exciting about that. Now, in addition to that, twice a week I send out a newsletter from ThinkLink, and one of them is called Glinkonomics, and that's the one that comes out on Thursday, and it's kind of my take, a little bit of what I do on the show, at the top of the show every Sunday, but also it's other things that are kind of crossing the path that I think are worthy of commentary on. But anyway, this week I talked about why it is that I personally no longer invest in individual stocks. So Sam and I, big man Sam, we actually invested in individual stocks for a very long time, and we did really well at it. And those were the days where we had more time, not as much money, and fewer obligations, right? Alex and Michael were young, and our businesses hadn't grown to where they are today. But we certainly were doing the research required, and at one point in time, we had as many as 70 stocks in 70 different companies. My mother's financial advisor laughed. I went to him one day, and I had this long list, and he goes, are you keeping up with all of these companies? And I said, well, truthfully, no. I no longer am. And he said, why are you invested like this? And I said, well, you know how it is, right? You plant a seed, it grows. You plant another seed, it grows. You plant another seed, it grows. And then one doesn't grow, but you feel so bad, you're emotionally involved in it. So you keep it, you think it'll do better. And so it was interesting. Through his help, we pared that list down to 10 companies. And from there, we literally just sold it all and ended up investing in mutual funds. And you know, this call that we had, you know, just a little bit ago about IRAs from Bob, right? He had a traditional IRA and he got a check for $8,900, invested it into an IRA, and really never thought about it after that. Never invested it, you know, didn't think about it, didn't change it, and now it's worth $15,200 22 years later. So it's less than doubled in 22 years, which is kind of an atrocious growth rate. But you know, he just sort of left it there and wasn't paying attention to it. And it reminded me of these three reasons that I stopped investing. Because when I see first-time investors take a stab at the stock market, they're always about the day trading, right? Like, oh, let's move fast. Let's go in and out. What about an ETF versus a regular? How can I day trade that? But who has time to day trade? Like, day trading you have time for one day, and then it's, oh, I have to do this and follow it every minute of every day. But everybody's busy. And most people, this isn't what they do. And when you don't do something full time and you dabble, you're a dabbler, as my grandfather used to say, that's when you lose money. So for my part, I made this decision a really long time ago not to buy individual stocks, even though I had made a lot of money in the past. Right? Last week, we had somebody call the show and told me that she was ready to start investing in a company that makes body cameras because she heard President Obama wants a camera on every cop and is going to invest $43 million to do it, or $400 million, whatever it was. And I think it's not a smart idea. It's good to get an idea about stocks and do the investigation, and then maybe you buy a little bit. But you've got to balance that out with a well-diversified portfolio. So why did I decide to stop investing in stocks? I'll give you three reasons. One, I have a problem with the way some companies keep their books, right? Everybody's supposed to report terms, report their finances in terms of GAAP, the General Audited Accounting Principles, GAAP, can't remember what it stands for today, Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. And so the books should all have similarity, but in reality, there's a lot of room for manipulation. And, you know, there was a spate of time where all kinds of companies were, you know, claiming they followed GAAP, but then there were all these irregularities, and it really messed with the stock market. It messed with their stock. But ultimately, I concluded that it was really good for the CEO and all the top executives of that company. Great. So if it doesn't work for me, you know, and everybody else, and for the CEOs, it's probably not good for you, an investor. So that was one reason. Second, I don't agree with the idea of putting all your eggs in one basket. So I'm a fan of good ideas in the stock market, but you shouldn't just rest it all on one good idea, even if you work for the company. I mean, it didn't work out so well for people who worked for Microsoft. Like, it did for a while when that stock was doubling in the 80s and early 90s, and then it kind of flattened out, and that was it. And the same thing with Intuit and so many other companies that are printing money. I mean, they're hugely profitable. Their stocks aren't going anywhere. So that's why even if you work for a company, it shouldn't be anywhere above 15% of your portfolio. So let me be really clear. One stock, one company should not be worth any more than 10 or 15% of your entire portfolio. And if it is, you are highly taking on way too much risk. You got to diversify that and figure out a better way. Number three, I have a full-time job, and it's not managing stocks for myself or anybody else. So as most of you know, I own a digital marketing company. I host this radio show. I write syndicated columns every week. I consult with all kinds of startups and help with communication strategies. Look, I have several full-time jobs. None of them involve watching the stock market on a daily basis. It's not what I do. And I don't have the time, if I'm really being honest, to do all the research necessary on individual companies to make sure that my money is being managed wisely. And technology is changing so quickly. Like, you know, even for our caller last week, I said to her, you know, what happens when robocops come along with the cameras built in? So unless the company that's making the cameras for the robos, the cops becomes the one for the robocops, you're going to be SOL. So you have to look way far down the line when you're investing. So I like index mutual funds. That's what I just recommended to Bob, because they're cheap, they're well diversified, and literally, if you have a job or it's 10, like I seem to, you can put it in, and I'm not saying forget about it, but it doesn't need the minute-by-minute watching that day trading needs. It's just a whole different animal. And I think a lot easier for people to manage. All right, let's go back to the phones, 404-872-0750, or I'll pay for this call, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Joey joins me on the line from Douglasville. Hi, Joey.
Yeah, hi, Liz. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I appreciate the service you do to help us maximize our dollars out here.
Well, I'm delighted to do it and delighted to be with you on this holiday weekend. What's going on?
Well, I'm at a point where I'm going to sell my property, my residence, in about 5 years.
This is your current residence?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to make a couple of modifications. I wanted to build on a little bit and correct a couple of things that would hinder the sale of it. So I wanted to spend about $30,000 in making those changes.
Okay.
I'm about 10 years into a 30-year refi that I did. My options are is to refi again and try to borrow that $30,000, or I have an equity line of credit with a $50,000 limit.
Mm-hmm.
My current mortgage rate, I think, is around 5%, and the equity line of credit is at about a 2.5 if I borrow on that. I heard you talking earlier about the interest rates, so they are, so I really just going to have to play with the numbers, I guess, and I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that. Should I use that money in the equity line or just refi again?
Well, I think if your mortgage rate is 5%, I'd really like to see you refi what you have left down to a 15-year, right? You've got 20 years left, so you ought to be able to go from a 20 years left on the term at 5% to a 15-year at 3%. And that should take your payment, because you're refinancing and you've already paid off a chunk of this mortgage, that should take your payments down very, very low. So
right.
That's the first thing I want to see you do. You're going to just spend a whole lot less money doing that. And you're going to pay off, even though you're going to sell this house in 5 years, that's going to pay off another huge chunk of that mortgage at a very, very low interest rate. So that's the first thing I want to see you do.
Okay.
Then I want to see you get an equity line for the another equity line, because you'll have to close off that equity line, even if you haven't borrowed against it when you refi, and you'll probably have to open up a new equity line, which is fine because the interest rate shouldn't be much higher than that anyway. And so you'll start the clock running, and then you can borrow against that equity line to fund whatever repairs and modifications you want to make. But just like I told Gloria, who bought her house a year ago and then put 30 into it, she's not sure that the 30, I'm not sure, let me just be really clear, I'm not sure that that 30 will pay off for her in a year. Likewise for you, whatever you're going to do, make sure that those improvements will actually pay off for you, and that in 5 years that $30,000 will come back to you in the form of a higher purchase price, or you're able to sell your house much faster or at all, given if you can or you can't. Just make sure you're making the smartest improvements that you can.
Yeah, it's the couple of things I was going to do are big, I think, killers in how quick I sell the property. You know, closet space and, of course, kitchens and that kind of thing are the big thing.
Mm-hmm, they are.
Especially for women that's going in to buy a new property.
Yeah,
and that's the downfall of the property at this point.
Right. So if you're doing that, those are really smart moves to make, and that will come back to you. Anything that makes the house look spanking brand new and shiny. And I would just encourage you to do it this year so you get to enjoy it over the next, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years until you sell that house. Or what you may find out is that in 5 years, because you've got the main mortgage down so cheap, you're able to rent that house and reap the benefits of having all of that nice new stuff, and somebody's going to pay you a premium for it, and that's good too. So this is going to give you a lot of options. But step number one for you, refinance your principal to a 15-year at 3% or less, then go for the home equity loan, and then start your renovation. 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink. We've got a prize pack coming up. Stay tuned for that on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
It's 12:25 on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours and WSB. Our weekend WSB McDonald's prize pack. It includes a 4-pack of tickets to see the Gwinnett Gladiators versus the Florida Everblades on January 24th at the Arena at Gwinnett Center, a 4-pack of tickets to the Great American Motorcycle Show January 23rd to the 25th at the North Atlanta Trade Center in Norcross, and a 4-pack of tickets to the Atlanta Camping and RV Show January 23rd to the 25th at the Atlanta Exposition Center South in Atlanta. Prize value $188. I'll give it away to the fifth caller, 404-741-0750. That's our prize line. You can only win once every 2 months. 1 month, I don't know. If you won last week, don't call back. And be nice to Crystal. She's taking your call. 26 minutes past the hour, Larry joins me on the line from Suwannee. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. Hi, Elise. Hey, I agree with, I don't do individual stocks. I've been a C executive in a couple of public companies, but not for one reason you said. Under Sarbanes-Oxley, when I had to sign a management letter identifying every variance, every risk, et cetera, if I was wrong or defrauded, I would go to jail. That's new under Sarbanes-Oxley, which came out after Enron and WorldCom. And so it was overkill, but it really caused the detail of the data to be very much more accurate and deeper. It was the CPA lobbies went after that because they get 4 to 5 times the fees for an audit. But the quality of the data today by companies is superb. And so that's not a factor not to, to invest, in my opinion. The other issue, though, is the odd lot theory. It's been proven statistically that individuals who buy stock always buy, they usually buy in odd lots, 20 versus 100, 50 mm-hmm. versus 100, and they're on the opposite side of what the market is. These professionals and prognosticators up there, they're way ahead of the individual buyer. They've already discounted positives and minuses long before the individual might hear about them. So always the individual is going to be on the wrong side of a buy or a sell statistically. It's proven.
So then index funds would be the way to go.
Index funds, the issue is index funds, I like those, but you better be good at understanding is the market going well or not. Within that, there are a lot of sectors that can be hotter or another. I won't name my one of my three investment companies, but one of them has a great straddle program. They'll get me into sectors that they think are going to be very strong over the next 2 years, and they'll say, we'll double anything above 10%, and it will give you a 10% downside protection. Amazing program because of wealthy investors, but you can really get huge returns with a lot of safety. I think a lot of them do this, but the issue is stay away from being an odd lot trader, a small trader. You can't win.
There you go. Well, thank you, Larry. That is, for all different reasons, terrific advice, and I appreciate you calling in. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. Back in a moment with more of the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Elise Glink, Sundays on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on WSB. Our number 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. Let's go back to the phones. Jim joins me on the line from Cumming. Hi, Jim.
How are you, Elise?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Terrific. I just have a quick question. I wanted you to share your experience with me. We're looking to purchase a home at auction on a foreclosure, and mm-hmm. it currently has residents, and the original purchasers of the property 10 years ago, and I'm pretty sure they don't want to leave. I just wonder what your experience is with evicting folks in this situation.
I haven't had to evict anybody, so my experience is counseling people who have had to evict people. What makes you think they don't want to leave?
I know some of the neighbors, so they're not real amenable.
Uh-huh.
I've had folks suggest to me that I go up and meet them, and my concern is with the destruction of the property, because I'm sure they're going to have to leave.
Yeah.
But the destruction that may be left behind. So the suggestion by a couple of realtors to me has been to go and offer them a cash subsidy upon their departure with the property intact.
And that's exactly what I was going to suggest to you, because lenders all over the country have worked that little deal very successfully, as well as investors. So what they do is they go to the renters and they say, look, you know, and this, you're in a better position to do this because you're a real person as opposed to some sort of institutional hedge fund. And you can go and say, look, I know this isn't working out the way that you had hoped. And I know that you really don't want to leave your house. And you may be tempted to just sort of blow it all up. And I really want to ask you not to do that. I am willing, after the closing, if you move out peacefully, you know, we'll put $3,000, $5,000, $7,000 into an escrow for you. And if you move out and the property's in good shape and you haven't damaged anything, we'll just hand that money over to you. And it'll, you know, it'll be there in this account, this escrow account. And as long as the instructions are, you know, these, you have to meet these things and do this kind of broom cleanup or whatever, you know, we're going to give that money to you. And we want you to start your new life. And we wish that this had worked out differently for you, but it didn't. So I want you to know we're going to take care of this house, and we wish you Godspeed. See if that works.
All right. I'll probably give that a try.
If it doesn't work, Jim, what you're going to want to do is consult with a real estate attorney, because it's nasty to have to evict people, and it'll take a while. And they probably will destroy part of the house, and it's just not going to work out well any way you put it. And then you're going to start paying the lawyer, and you're going to have to pay court fees and costs. So that's why it's worth it to put enough money down on the table so that these people can actually understand where they're going to be able to go from there.
All right. I appreciate that very much, Elise. Thank you.
You're welcome, Jim. Let me know what happens, okay? It's a very tough situation when you have to do it. I think institutional investors and the people who do it for them over and over again, they get a little immune to it. But for you, this is your one and only, and you're going to go live in that house, and I want it to go well for you. 404-872-0750. Sandy joins me on the line. Hi, Sandy.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you this holiday weekend?
I'm doing pretty good, just working on, you know, some odds and ends that have to do with taxes and real estate and, you know, financial things today, so it's great.
All right, so what can I help you with?
Well, my question is that we're looking at trying to pay off our primary home within the next 5 to 7 years that will fit into a retirement plan. And right now it's 2 years off of a 15-year mortgage that we had refinanced at 3.5%.
Uh-huh.
We're looking at, my husband keeps saying, how about taking this rental that we've had for the last 25 years, pay that off, and then put that money in towards the primary mortgage here so that we can accelerate those payments and pay down the majority of it long before I am looking to retire.
Okay.
So how does that seem to work? Would that be something that would be feasible, or am I making some technical mistakes?
How much?
Taking a rental.
All right, so let me ask a question. So how much money is left on the rental mortgage?
$22,000.
Okay. And so, how much is your payment every month?
My payment is about, I think, $600 to $700. We're taking in about we're taking in about $1,400, and that $600 to $700 does not include the taxes.
Okay, so roughly you're paying about $1,000 a month in expenses, and you've got $1,400 a month coming in?
Absolutely.
And so he's suggesting taking the extra $400 a month and just prepaying that mortgage? Or you have cash available to just pay it off?
I have cash available that we could put onto the primary, or we could pay off this rental mortgage and then take $1,000 a month and put it towards our primary.
I think that's what I would do.
Okay.
And how much is your primary mortgage?
Primary mortgage right now we owe $140. I just looked. The interest rate's at 3.5%. So I'm also listening about the fact that you're saying look at refinancing. I don't know if that's a good move on our case because it's so close. The only thing I was thinking about is maybe an ARM, a 5 or 7 ARM.
If you could do a 5 or 7 year ARM, or you could look at a 10-year mortgage. A 10-year mortgage might even be 2.75%.
Okay.
If you could go with a 10-year loan, and if you could take the $22,000 or $25,000 that you have in cash and use that to get yourselves down to a 10-year, mm-hmm. where you are basically either have the same payment or even a little bit higher, but it wouldn't matter because now you're going down to 10 years. So you're going to save 5 years worth of payments. Then
right.
that would tilt it for me.
Uh-huh.
And I would say you'd probably want to take the $25,000 and pour it into getting that loan down to 10 years. And then you could just use the extra $400 a month and pay off the $22,000. Right?
Okay.
And then when that's done, which will be probably, if you took an extra $400, that would be $5,000 a year. So you'd probably get that mortgage paid off in 2 years, just
okay.
with the extra $400 a month.
Uh-huh.
And then you'd be able to take that money and pour it into the 10-year loan and get that off in 7 years. So you could have both things paid off in 7 years or less.
Okay.
And that would be really cool.
And I still have the tax advantage in the meantime with the rental as well.
Yeah, whatever is left, right?
Because yeah, there's not much.
There's not much there. So, yeah, you'd still have a little bit of that, and you're still able to write off the taxes and, you know, the house payment or whatever else it is. But at least then you'd be able to get things paid off. And so, again, I'm going to just repeat my four rules for a home run refinance, right? Because you want to think about all these. One is lowering the interest rate.
Right.
Two is lowering your monthly payment. Three is shortening your loan term, which by far is the most important thing for saving money. And four is watching your closing costs, because if it costs you an arm and a leg, like $5,000 to $10,000 to refinance, totally not worthwhile, right?
Right.
So you have to look at that. So let's say that, sure, you could lower the interest rate, but the payment's going to be higher and the closing costs are outrageous. Then you take the $25,000, you pay off the rental, and then you pour all of that money into the mortgage you have. Because, frankly, a 3.5% mortgage is an awesome mortgage.
I know. That was great.
So you're really, it's like you're almost not paying interest on the money anyway. So getting rid of the other one, which is basically all cash now, and then pouring everything into the 15-year, you may end up getting rid of that loan, you know, lickety-split, and or at least it'll be 10 years. You'll take it from 15 years to 10 years or less, just doing what your husband suggests. So you're going to have to run those numbers and see, but either way, you're in great shape.
All right. Well, I really appreciate the information. It gives us a little bit to talk about this afternoon, and I appreciate everything you do for us on the radio.
Oh, you're welcome, Sandy. Thanks so much for listening and for calling in. Have a great holiday weekend. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Let's see if we can get started on another call. Shawshank joins me on the line from Alpharetta. Is that your name, Shawshank?
Well, it's pretty darn close, and I've heard that one come through a lot of times before. It's actually Shashank.
Shashank. Sounds
yes.
good. Well, welcome to the program. How can I help you today?
Thank you very much for taking my call. So my wife and I recently decided to buy a new home, and we have our current home that's completely paid off. And we just wanted to figure out whether it would be a smart thing to rent the current home that we live in, or should we sell it and maybe put some of the money towards a rainy day fund and maybe invest the rest of the proceeds.
So I'm all about rainy day funds. And you've paid off this one home. Now you're going to buy a new home, so you want to put down at least 20%, because then you don't pay private
mortgage.
Yes,
we are doing that. We are
Great.
Doing that.
All right, so that's number one off the list. I think you have to think about whether you're the kind of person who wants to be a real estate investor or not. Do you want to manage rental properties, or do you have a different life?
Yeah.
I'm asking because I think people don't think about this question enough. And I'll just tell you from personal experience, I love the idea of rental properties. And my husband, Sam, who's a real estate lawyer, hates them.
Right.
I mean, he manages the two that we have, and I got to tell you, he's like, I could be making more money being a real estate lawyer than we're making in these properties, and it's a pain in the neck. And I'm telling you, we have great tenants. It's trouble-free. We never have to go and unclog toilets. But Sam, you know, this is not his great love. So are you, at heart, a real estate manager? Are you a real estate investor?
Well, this is my one chance where I think I can be one, and I ran the numbers, right? So on this new home that we are buying, the PNI, the monthly mortgage, is $2,800.
Okay.
And I looked up my current home on Zillow, and the rent estimate is about $1,500. So effectively, if I can get a renter to come in at that and pay me that much monthly rent, even if there's a minor, maybe some real estate management fees if I hire someone. And the big plus is this: the current home and a new home are just within a mile and a half of each other. So if I need to stop by, it's not much of an inconvenience.
That is, okay, so all of those things are terrific, and I absolutely agree that being close by is the way to go. On your $1,500 a month that you're getting in, don't forget you still have to pay real estate taxes, which are right. You can write off against the income coming in. You're going to have to pay income tax on that. There's depreciation, which could help you in the long run. And on the other side, the home may still appreciate in value. So if you're going to try it now for the next year or two, because you can still, as long as you've lived in the home for two of the last 5 years, there's still some tax benefits to it. So try it for a year, see if you like it, and if it's as easy as you think it's going to be, and if not, sell and move on. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. It's 49 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, answering your money and real estate questions. Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Starting with yours. News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.
It's 55 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show. I was just saying to Andrew, who's running the board today, I just love this song. It's such a, just a good song. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours here in WSB, 404-872-0750. And before we go back to the phones, I should say, check out WhitNation.com for my new daily video show, Big Money Real Estate, designed to help real estate investors and just people interested in real estate. All about some of the things that are going on. It's like doing this show, but on video every single day. We've got a 3 to 5 minute update. It's at witnation.com, WITNATION.com. And that channel is already getting 8 million video views a month. It is way, way cool. So you can certainly follow me on Twitter, get links to it, or just go to WitNation, click on my smiling face. And then if you've got other questions, you can always email me at questions at thinklink.com. And I will do my best to get back to you. Linda joins me on the line from Alpharetta. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
You know, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I have a mortgage that can be paid off in about 14 months.
Mm-hmm.
And in having that mortgage 14 months, and the value of the home is good, it stayed stable, everything like that is good. I have a child who's starting college in fall of 2015.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I plan to work another 10 or 11 years and have a well-established retirement plan, but I don't have much cash reserve. And so my question is, like, cool things, you know, from my house, do I refinance at the lower rate of currently 5.25%, which I could refinance, and I've got a great credit score, and I don't have any other debt. So just wanted some advice as far as which way to go. I continue to maintain my home, but it's got some bigger things coming on board, like windows.
So, Linda, let me ask you a question. You have do you have any college savings whatsoever?
I really don't have, but I do have an opportunity as an educator for a possible tuition exchange program if that goes through.
Okay.
Which means my son would have tuition free, and I'd only be paying for room and board. So I do have some things that may work out.
Have you applied for done the FAFSA form yet?
I will be, you know, as soon as I get everything together this month.
So let me lay it out for you in a way that I think would make sense. First of all, tuition-free exchange, that should be, you know, the top thing you look for. Or there's the Georgia Hope Scholarship, which you may still qualify for. I assume your child has done well?
Correct.
So that's always a plus. And I think you can't overstate the benefit of emerging debt-free from college.
Right.
Which you really have to share what those costs are and help your child learn the difference between taking on debt like that, because they'll have to take on debt too. Or not. And I really am not in favor of you mortgaging your future in order to pay his or her college tuition.
Okay.
So the other thing to think about is taking on debt. If your child takes it out for school, the interest starts to accrue after school is done, after 4 years. And then you can think about saving money for another 4 years and then getting it paid off. So that is one way to think about getting that paid. But you may also want, and if none of those things work out, I would much rather see you get a home equity line of credit or refinance and do a cash out refinance where you've got these incredibly low interest rates of 2% and 3% and get the whole thing paid off in 15 years for your child. Much rather see you do that than get stuck with huge debt at 4% or 6% or 8% down the line. So cheapest loan possible, but if you can, get it for free first. Thank you so much for your call. Music's playing. Time to go. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Find me on witnation.com, thinklink.com, questions at thinklink.com, Twitter at Glink, or Facebook. Have a great and happy holiday and a terrific week. See you next week.